41,000 Syracuse residents were below the poverty line in 2016.
At its core, poverty is about pushing down instead of having an opportunity to go up.
It's, generally speaking, lack of access to opportunity.
This is City Limits, a poverty project.
This is City Limits. I'm Scott Willis. Let's say you live in a neighborhood where every fourth house has a new resident every year. That's the rate of turnover you'd witness on large swaths of Syracuse's west and north sides, not by choice, but mainly due to evictions. It's right here in the South Side Brighton area where it's probably safe to say many eviction cases originate. I'm standing at the corner of Hudson and Marginal Streets on the banks of Onondaga Creek. Most of the housing stock is old, and many homes are in disrepair. Porches are collapsing on some of them, tarps cover roofs, some are boarded up. Data from the Volunteer Lawyers Project of Onondaga County show the neighborhood has one of the highest concentrations of cases that went to court between 2012 and 2016.
I've been in this court 15 years, and honestly, at least twice a week, I end up in tears with the tenants because the stories just can become extremely profound. The injustices that happen are not of their making oftentimes. A lot of times they are of the tenants' making. But when people have had one interference of life after the other that keeps beating them down, this gets to be the final step.
Deborah O'Shea is pro bono coordinator of eviction defense programs with the Volunteer Lawyers Project of Onondaga County. Other data compiled by the VLP show the highest poverty rates in Syracuse and the most code violations are also found in the Holly Green, Prospect Hill, Northside, Washington Square, and Little Italy neighborhoods. That's not to mention the near west side, southwest, and parts of the North Valley. A big factor in all of this is that just over one-third of Syracuse residents own their homes. The rest are renters. Roughly 25% of the city's population moves within a year, the highest of any upstate city, mostly because of evictions. Every year, there are 8 to 11,000 evictions in Syracuse, the vast majority of them affecting single mothers and their children living in units many would consider substandard, maybe even squalid. So what are their options when they get that eviction notice? Who can they turn to when they can't afford rent, let alone legal representation? That's where the Volunteer Lawyers Project, Legal Services of Central New York, and other agencies come in to handle their cases for free in landlord-tenant court. They gather here every morning on the lower level of the criminal courthouse on South State Street. The hallway outside the courtroom is buzzing with activity as clients meet with lawyers before the judge calls their cases. The volume is still more than the agencies or court can handle. VLP takes on about 1,000 cases per year, typically simpler ones involving disputes over unpaid rent. Most avoid eviction, at least temporarily, after the parties agree to a payment plan with hard deadlines. Meanwhile, legal services lawyers will tackle around 300 of the more complex cases involving Section 8 or other subsidized housing. In this story, we'll spotlight both types of cases, while also digging deeper into why evictions are so prevalent in Syracuse, how they factor into the city's high poverty rate, and the lasting impact on tenants and neighborhoods. Deborah O'Shea can tell you stories, countless stories, of people down on their luck, not knowing where they'll be sleeping in 72 hours, 2 weeks, a month, whatever the court might decide in the mere seconds a case spends before a judge. O'Shea arrives at landlord-tenant court at 8:45 every morning. Her task? Triaging and assigning cases, which can range from just a handful to as many as three dozen per day.
It can be a bit overwhelming. The judge gets on the bench at 9:30. We never know what to expect. The courtroom doesn't open up till 20 after 9, but I'm there with copies of the calendar, our case intake. I've already done my homework, which is making sure I know what the code's violations are against the properties. And I also want to know who the responsible owner is. And that's important toward the defenses that we utilize.
She approaches clients waiting in the busy hallway outside the courtroom, letting them know she and the lawyers are there to help untangle what happens on the other side of the double doors.
If someone were watching me do an an intake, the questions seem very superficial. How many adults? How many children? What are your source of income? All those questions have multiple layers behind them. It lets me know where they fall within federal poverty. It lets me know what benefits are out there for people that have that number of children, that income coming in that we could help them out later on.
This is when she learns the terrible plight of so many tenants. One recent morning, as I observed the routine in court, O'Shea meets a single mother of four children who just moved in February. She already owes $2,200 in back rent. She's supposed to pay $920 a month. O'Shea tells the tenant the landlord is probably frustrated, so she has to assure the attorney and the judge that she can make payments by the dates she agrees to in court. In the end, she is allowed to stay, but O'Shea is worried it won't be for long. She says the tenant just doesn't make enough money to keep up with rent and take care of her children. She urges the mother to apply for emergency assistance with the Department of Social Services. She's among the nearly one-third of renters in Syracuse who spend more than 50% of their income on housing. The federal affordability standard is 30%. O'Shea says aside from falling behind, that means many tenants are one illness, one death in the family, one life event away from eviction, and possible homelessness.
I had a case a few months ago where mom got profoundly sick. She had a good job with four children, and she knew she was going to be out of work for at least 1 or 2 months. She sold her car to be able to help pay her rent. She was 2 months in arrears, taken to court. This was right before Christmas, and she was able to figure out how she could get the rest of the money that she owed to be able to stay, except for the fact that she didn't realize she signed a lease that said that she was responsible for court costs, attorney's fees, filing fees. So the fees added up to $735. The landlord's attorney wouldn't give on it. So there she was sobbing because it meant she was going to be evicted. She couldn't pay that amount of money. My heart just broke. It wasn't her fault. It wasn't her fault. And she, you know, even selling her car, and if she had to move, now what do I do?
She's also noticed a gradual trend over the years where rent increasingly outpaces income and that tenants will continue to fall behind no matter what payment plans are worked out. They're usually just buying time. Unfortunately, O'Shea says she sees many of the same faces in court weeks or months later.
I've had this client since 2011 when he first showed up. A young man in his early 20s that was shot and a bullet is lodged in his back. So he is for life paralyzed. And, you know, he's a big young guy and his wheelchair is a larger wheelchair. He needs to be in a wheelchair accessible apartment. His income is SSD. It's set at $820 a month. The rents in the city of Syracuse are going up and up. So right now, he's at a point where he is in an apartment where the rent is $750. He brings in $820. Nothing is left. So he's finding himself back in court frequently. I think I've had him 9 times in the last, it's just terrible, the last 6 years. And in court the other day, the landlord said, well, we're tired of, we want him out. And he's saying, I just can't get out. Where do I go?
With this case, O'Shea says they took a more active role in searching for another unit, including calling the landlord to see if he could move the client to a less expensive place. She says many compelling cases come back to court over and over again with seemingly no way to resolve them. Then there are those eviction cases that are rather atypical and a lot more complicated. I'm at the Salve Senior Apartments, which might be the last place you'd imagine an eviction or the circumstances surrounding it. Veronica Casolaire could hardly believe it herself. The complex provides subsidized housing and sits atop a hill overlooking a park adjacent to a neighborhood with well-kept homes. Casolaire says she loved the place, but the problems began within a week of moving in when a 27-year-old resident with an intellectual disability started stalking her. HUD rules allow younger residents with disabilities to reside in senior housing. Casolaire says his behavior continued until she was forced out a year and a half later.
So I come in at night. He has to be escorted in and escorted out of this building by his parents. So he'd wait till they left, hide behind the curtains, in the community room, watch whoever, and then he'd come out and go behind a pillar. So you couldn't see him until you were right there at the door. So I said, I've had enough of this. I went to the police. Then the manager found out that I had gone to the police, so she called the mother, and the mother and the manager went to the police.
She says the manager and the man's mother accused her of harassment. Several incidents followed with more calls to the police when Casolaire says there was a final dangerous confrontation in the laundry room. She's joined by Legal Services staff attorney Elizabeth Beltran.
So I start to leave to go upstairs, and he's sitting out there. Next thing I know, he had punched me here. I'm on the floor. He kicked me. I don't see my dog. He had kicked the car. She had flown. She's only a little 8 pound. Flown across the laundry room.
Shortly thereafter, Veronica got a notice of eviction. And I took the case because it seemed like they were retaliating against her for her reporting the incident to the police. The police issued a temporary restraining order due to the incident. I don't believe you even pursued that restraining order. Retaliatory evictions aren't normally successful. It's usually comes down to a he said, she said sort of situation, and usually there are other defenses to have. In this case, there wasn't. I asked to see her file, which she has a legal right to. It's protected under the due process clause of the Constitution, and they denied me her file. They denied it for over a month. When I finally got parts of the file, they had attempted to build sort of an eviction case for her. A reason to break the lease was behavior that violates community policy, several of which were her calls to the police to report being stalked. She was issued basically citations by the property management for calling the police to report stalking, which is against the VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act. That's against federal law. And then I also found the vast majority of the complaints were actually logged by the mother of the young man who had attacked her, who doesn't reside in the property.
But leaving put Casolaire in quite the quandary.
That's a huge thing for a senior to be evicted, because the wait list is around 3 years. There's not a lot of places to go, and she definitely needed subsidized rent.
Did you ever think it would get to this point? Like, how were you surprised?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It was a matter of a simple phone call.
It is ironic that this young man did have criminal cases of assault pending against him, and yet it was my client that was evicted. And that is highly problematic.
Casolaire was able to stay with a family member, an option many don't have. She's ready to leave, but finding another place of her own could prove very difficult. Legal Services Executive Director Dennis Kaufman chimes in to explain.
Every place you go, there's going to be a reference letter. Is that reference letter going to say about me? You see what I'm saying?
Right.
This is going to go on and on and on.
She's got a negative reference now if she were ever to go someplace else. More than that, some clients default. They have a judgment against them. They have an order of eviction against them. So when a landlord runs a credit check on that person to see if they'll accept them as a tenant, that's going to show up. Yeah. And they build over a period of time.
I don't have that, do I?
No, you don't have that. Right.
Okay,
you had representation. But if she went in there by herself, chances are really good she would have had an order of eviction and maybe a judgment.
Correct.
They still want some money from you, right?
Yeah.
Legal representation is key in these cases where the playing field is far from level. Kaufman says 90% of landlords come to eviction court with an attorney, while 90% of tenants do not.
What lawyers could do is to make that process work for the tenant. So if a client comes in and says, yeah, I didn't pay my rent because the stairs to the second floor are caving in, you know, we could raise the defense that the landlord has not met their obligation under what's called the warranty of habitability. That place is just not habitable. So if their rent was $600 a month, the judge can reduce it because they didn't have a safe way to get to the second floor, to the kids' bedrooms.
So what's the larger implication of evictions on families, or say here at the intersection of Pond and Carbon Streets in Washington Square? There's a mix of residential development in this area, single-family homes, also larger homes that are probably divided into apartments, and smaller apartment complexes. Data show layer upon layer of eviction cases in this area, a constant churn that would lead to instability in any neighborhood. Kaufman says first, there's the human toll.
Certainly there are, you know, single people, but they probably have a better ability to pick up and move and find someplace else. Okay, when you're a family, and a lot of the families, it's a single mom, one or two kids, mom is probably working at least part-time somewhere. So now, you know, she's facing, oh, I got to take time off from my job to go down to court. I got to make sure that if my kids aren't in school, that there's somebody to take care of them. So the cost of being involved is great on that particular tenant also, you know, which has a negative effect on the family situation. When a family gets uprooted from their home, there are a lot of consequences that could plunge that family into poverty.
Much like the Volunteer Lawyers Project, Kaufman says his staff attorneys also typically don't know what happens to a client after they reach a settlement in court. Sometimes, he says, they find out when the process starts all over again.
3 months later, they're going to be back because they're in a new place. The place is awful. They don't want to pay rent. They're withholding the rent, and they're being evicted again. What's very hard for our lawyers is that they do an eviction case, and maybe the outcome is we get them an extra 2 or 3 weeks before they have to move out. You know, there's a little settlement negotiation. You know, we say goodbye to our client at the courthouse door. But that's it. We say goodbye to them. We don't know. I mean, we know sort of generally what's going to happen to them, but we don't know what's going to happen to that particular family.
Then there's the impact on what makes a neighborhood a neighborhood. The glue, the fabric that keeps it together.
You know, you have a lot of turnover because of evictions in a neighborhood. It's not a very stable neighborhood because of that. People don't develop those kind of ties and don't rely on each other because they don't know each other. That's another thing that we could do here is instead of looking at just an individual's problem, we could look at how it fits into the community's problem.
Kaufman has had some time to reflect on that after decades of advocacy, going back to his days as a law student intern at Legal Services in the early 1970s.
You know, what is poverty? We know, we see it in the people we work with. Poverty is multidimensional. You know, at one time everyone thought poverty is you don't have enough money. But it's way more than that. I like to say that the four major components of people we see in poverty are race, space, place, and gender. And the difference between space and place being that the space is where you're actually living in that unit and the place is where what neighborhood you're in. Those four factors coalesce in parts of our cities and in rural areas to create more than just, oh, well, I meet the federal poverty guidelines. But poverty is a much more inclusive and multidimensional problem than just lack of money.
Maybe that broader multidimensional picture is something that should concern more of us if Syracuse is to make any headway out of its pervasive and seemingly intractable poverty problem. We've heard how incomes just aren't keeping pace with increasing rents, creating what might be called an epidemic of evictions. We've heard the toll evictions can take on families, especially children, as well as those with disabilities and even seniors. We've heard how their situations could be far worse without legal representation. We've heard how unstable housing contributes to poverty. And we've heard how the constant turnover leaves neighborhoods disconnected. So it's clear evictions have consequences far broader than one family being uprooted, with damaging societal impacts. What's not clear is the solution to this complicated problem. We do know that ignoring it will continue to tear at the fabric that holds the larger community together. For City Limits, I'm Scott Willis, WAER News. More information on Legal Services of Central New York is online at lscny.org. The Volunteer Lawyers Project website is on vlp.org. VLP provided data to the Eviction Lab, a website and database created by Princeton University sociology professor Matthew Desmond. He's been studying housing, poverty, and eviction since 2008. Desmond is author of the book Evicted and has been a guest on Fresh Air and other NPR programs.
City Limits is a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. and is funded by generous grant support from the Central New York Community Foundation, Grossman St. Amour CPAs, National Grid, and listeners like you. To support the project, visit the City Limits About page at citylimitsproject.org. Stay tuned for more stories from this series and subscribe in iTunes for automatic delivery of new episodes.